are complete with the allocation of time. Our thanks to both Mr. Penz and Ms. Sickles for their fine briefs. The case will be taken under advisement. The next case of the morning is number 032997, David Lozano against Frank Matthew Frank. Ms. Altshuler.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Stuart Altshuler. I've been appointed by the Court to represent the appellant, David Lozano, Jr., and this is his appeal from the District Court's dismissal of his habeas petition.
Counsel, why was this case filed under seal?
Because Mr. Lozano is in the witness protection program, and his location is being kept confidential. I made a motion to unseal, and I believe what's now on the public file has been redacted so that his location is not being disclosed.
That was the main thing, the location?
Yes, sir. David Lozano was a 15-year-old boy when the Milwaukee police arrested him, kept him in solitary confinement for 12 straight hours, and interrogated him without access to counsel or to any friendly adult. And he was 16 years old when he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to life in prison, and when his appellate process began. I'd like to summarize very quickly the petition's underlying constitutional claims and then discuss the timeliness issue, which was the sole basis for the district court's dismissal of the petition. The petition raises three basic claims. First, denial of the right to counsel during interrogation. Second, coerced confession. And third, ineffective assistance of counsel, both trial counsel and appellate counsel. As to the first claim, denial of the right to counsel during interrogation, at David's suppression hearing, the judge refused to consider even the possibility that David's father had effectively invoked his 15-year-old son's right to counsel. The judge's categorical position was that parents can never invoke a child's right to counsel, no matter how young and unsophisticated the child may be, and regardless of all other surrounding circumstances. That per se rule violated controlling federal law because the Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized that juvenile interrogations and juvenile waivers raise special concerns and require a searching review of the totality of the circumstances, including the presence and conduct of the juvenile's parent. That's the teaching of the Supreme Court's decisions in Haley and Gallegos and Galt and other cases. Now, on this first claim, the state effectively concedes that the trial judge made a constitutional error. The state makes no attempt to defend the judge's per se ruling. The state avoids that issue and tries to change the subject by discussing Lozano's second claim instead, the claim that his confession was coerced. Turning then to the second claim, coerced confession. Here was a 15-year-old boy who was held in solitary confinement for 12 straight hours. He had no access to his parents or any other friendly adult. He was interrogated in relays by three different teams of detectives. And between interrogation sessions, he was locked alone in the interrogation room for hours on end. All of that is undisputed. Now, the judge failed to conduct the necessary searching review of these and other circumstances. For example, he made no explicit reference to the 12 hours of isolation. He made no explicit reference to the absence of any friendly adult. He made no explicit reference to other specific facts relating to the interrogation. Furthermore, he actually cut off any inquiry into a crucial circumstance, which was the question whether David's father tried to talk to his son while his son was in custody. The judge said flatly that was irrelevant. But the Supreme Court and this court have always considered it relevant whether a parent tries to talk to his minor child while the child is in custody. It's not just relevant, it's critical. That was the second constitutional violation. The third claim in the habeas petition, actually the third set of claims, is ineffective assistance of counsel at every possible stage, at the suppression hearing, at trial, and during the first stage appeal. I don't have to say anything about the merits of those claims because the state never disputes the merits. It's undisputed here that Lozano's trial counsel and appellate counsel were grossly ineffective. The state's only objections are procedural. The state raises procedural default and failure to exhaust state remedies. Now, the record has some gaps. Some of the filings are missing, but what's there is enough to show that Lozano adequately presented his claims. He raised his claims at the first opportunity on direct review, as soon as he discovered that his appellate counsel had failed to raise any constitutional claims and had filed a no-merits petition in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Lozano immediately filed a handwritten set of additional claims, including explicitly his ineffective assistance claims, which the court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, expressly acknowledged even though it denied review. Then he tried to raise them again on collateral review in both the Wisconsin Court of Appeals and the Wisconsin Supreme Court when he was confronted with the argument that he had waived all of his constitutional claims. When you put the pieces together, you'll see that he adequately raised his claims, especially when you apply two basic rules. First, pro se pleadings must be liberally construed. And second, there's a presumption, a strong presumption, against the waiver of constitutional rights. And this court applied that principle explicitly in Page v. Frank, which involved a very similar set of circumstances where a pro se petitioner was trying to navigate his way through the Byzantine maze and inconsistent procedures that the Wisconsin state courts have established for the assertion of ineffective assistance claims. Which brings me to my final point, the timeliness issue. Timeliness was the sole basis for the district court's dismissal of the petition. The argument here is simple. Lozano's petition was timely because it was filed within 1 year of a proceeding that qualified as direct review under Wisconsin state law. That proceeding was the modification of Lozano's sentence by the state trial court in 2002. He obtained that modification under Section 973.19 of the Wisconsin statutes, which is unquestionably a vehicle of direct review. The state never challenges the basic premise that 973.19 is a vehicle of direct review and all proceedings under that provision constitute direct review. The state's only argument is that 973.19 could not possibly provide a basis for Lozano's sentence modification because his modification was based on so-called new factors. But as I've shown at length in my reply brief, 973.19 applies to all sentence modifications based on any substantive grounds, including new factors. The Wisconsin courts have repeatedly applied Section 973.19 to motions based on new factors. And once that's recognized, the state's argument on timeliness fails. Lozano's sentence modification qualifies as direct review, and his habeas petition was timely. Questions. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Altshuler.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Moeller, representing the respondent Matthew Frank. In the state's view, the only issue that this court needs to address is the question of timeliness of the habeas petition. It's undisputed that Lozano's direct appeal ended on February 14, 1994, which was 90 days after the Wisconsin Supreme Court had denied his petition for review on direct appeal. Therefore, under the one-year grace period for prisoners whose convictions became final prior to the adoption of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, Lozano had either until April 24, 1997, or May 27, 1999, and this latter date would apply if we assume that a pro se motion he filed toward the end of the one-year period on March 26, 1997, if we assume that the pendency of that motion told the one-year period, then he had till May 27, 1999, to file a federal habeas petition. The filing, in fact, occurred August 7th of 2002, which is either 3 years or 5 years outside of the one-year limitation period, unless this court were to adopt Lozano's position that when the state circuit court granted his motion for sentence modification based on a new factor and then entered a modified judgment of conviction in March of 2002, that action by the state circuit court somehow reset the federal clock and gave him 1 year from March of 2002 to file his habeas petition.
Is there any right of appeal from the order?
He could have appealed totally on the basis that the circuit court did not grant a portion of his sentence modification request, which was to alter his parole eligibility date. That is one thing he could have brought up to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. He did not do so. The state has relied on a case decided by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals in 2002, State versus Knoll, that has never been overruled by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. That is still good law, which makes a distinction between sentence modification motions based on a new factor, which is clearly the case with Lozano's motion that was brought in 2001, and that new factor was his cooperation with federal authorities to give testimony against gang members of the Latin Kings, which then resulted in their conviction. So that cooperation is what caused the Wisconsin trial court to make his armed robbery sentence run concurrent with rather than consecutive to his sentence for first-degree murder. Knoll says that kind of a motion is within the inherent power of a trial court. It was not brought under 973.19. Now, obviously, Lozano disagrees with Knoll because that is the only way that he can get around the one-year limitation by saying that his motion was, in fact, a 973.19 motion. But Knoll says it was not. And in this regard, I think it's important to realize what the effect of adopting his position would be. A defendant can make more than one motion for sentence modification based on a new factor, because by its very definition, a new factor is something that arises after the original sentence is imposed. So taking this case as an example, Mr. Lozano, let's say if he were to suffer an unfortunate accident while he was in prison and it rendered him paralyzed, his attorney could come before the Wisconsin trial court again and say, you should modify his parole eligibility. Instead of making him eligible for parole in 2025, make him eligible for parole right now, because he no longer poses any danger to society if he's released from prison. And the Wisconsin trial court would have the ability to again modify Lozano's sentence, to again enter a modified judgment of conviction. But under his theory, that would be a continuation of direct review. It simply does not make any sense, because under that theory, there is no finality for federal habeas corpus purposes, because had he not brought this habeas petition in 2002, under his theory, if an accident happened 5 years from now and a new judgment of conviction were entered, he could bring a habeas petition then. And that's also why this case is distinguishable from Orange versus Calbone, because in that situation, you had an appeal out of time, being granted by a state court, which in effect allowed the defendant to bring a whole new direct appeal. That would only be analogous to the Wisconsin situation where under State versus Knight, if a prisoner claims that he was denied effective assistance of counsel on direct appeal and the Wisconsin Court of Appeals agrees, the appellate court gives the prisoner a whole new direct appeal, starting back in the trial court, filing a 974.02 motion if he or she so desires. Under that situation, the state would agree. That would then reset the federal clock and allow the person to bring a habeas petition 1 year after that reinstituted direct appeal time had run out. That is not what happened here. I think it's also telling that in his reply brief, Mr. Lozano at page 11, footnote 6, in an effort to distinguish Wisconsin's statutory structure from that of Oklahoma, says that if a state law allows a trial court to modify a sentence while an appeal is pending, that is an indication that sentence modification is separate and distinct from direct review. And that is precisely what the situation is in Wisconsin. Under section 808.0754G6, which I cited to this court in a letter submitted yesterday, March 29th, a copy of the statute being attached to my letter, Wisconsin law does allow a trial court to modify a sentence even while an appeal is pending. So in other words, if Mr. Lozano, while his direct appeal is pending, had cooperated with federal authorities at that time, nothing would have prevented him from going to the circuit court and saying, "Judge, we have a new factor. Wasn't in existence when you sentenced me, but it is now. And could you please modify my sentences to make them concurrent, change my parole eligibility?" And the Wisconsin trial court could have done that even while Mr. Lozano's appeal challenging the sufficiency of the evidence to convict him was pending before the Wisconsin Court of Appeal. So I think that's a big difference from the situation in Orange versus Calbone, but it also shows that Mr. Lozano's concession in his reply brief actually applies to the statutes of Wisconsin, which in fact are similar to Oklahoma's in this regard. So it's the state's position that this court need not address any of the constitutional issues that Lozano has briefed because the district court correctly denied the petition on the basis that it was untimely filed. However, if this court were to disagree with the state and find that there was timeliness under the theory that Lozano has advanced, then the appropriate procedure would be to remand to the district court to allow that court to be the first to address those constitutional claims, because admittedly, the record in the district court did not even contain some documents that would be essential in the state's view to resolving those issues, including the actual statements whose voluntariness Lozano is challenging in this federal habeas corpus proceeding. So if there are no questions from the court, the state would rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mulder. Mr. Altshuler, you have 2 minutes, please.
I have to protest because I have not read the letter. I have not seen the letter that the state's counsel has just referred to. She mentioned that it was filed yesterday. I have not been served with a copy. I have not seen it, and I request permission from the court to file a response to that letter.
Sure.
May I have 2 weeks?
2 weeks will be fine.
Thank you. I just want to address one other issue that the state's counsel has raised, and that is the straw man of successive habeas petitions after further sentence modifications in state court. There are ample doctrines under federal law to cut off successive habeas petitions, so I consider that a red herring. I will respond to the state's letter in due course by 14 days from now, and I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Altshuler. Mr. Altshuler, you did serve by appointment to the court, and the court wants to express its deep gratitude to you for taking on the case and doing such a fine job on behalf of your client.
Thank you, Judge.
And our thanks as well to Ms. Mulder for a fine presentation today. And the case will be taken under advisement. We have finished the call of the day, and therefore the court will rise until 9:30 tomorrow.